welcome to the January 2010 podcast for Neurosurgical Focus. The theme this month is neurogenomics and neuroproteomics. In this podcast, topic editor Dr. James Rutka speaks with co-author Dr. Michael Taylor on issues relating to their article on genomics of medulloblastoma, from Gims Abanding to Next Generation Sequencing in 20 Years. Both authors are affiliated with the Arthur and Sonia Labatt Brain Tumor Research Center in Toronto, as well as the Department of Laboratory Medicine and Pathobiology at the University of Toronto.
So, Michael, why don't you summarize the findings in your laboratory that relate to this publication in Neurosurgical Focus?
The paper in Neurosurgical Focus covers the start of genomics from approximately 20 years ago when people were first looking at G-banding, so simple Gims banding of chromosomes from metaphases in cancers, all the way up to the current day where people are using something called next-generation sequencing to sequence the entire genome of cancers.
Now, I was in the laboratory in the 80s, and I certainly remember using Gims banding to look at karyotypes and how labor-intense that was. In what ways have the technologies improved delivery of information to the scientists?
So when you did an experiment using Gims banding on chromosomes from a given brain tumor, let's say medulloblastoma, you were only able to see abnormalities that were at least 20 to 30 million base pairs in size. So you had to have a deletion in the genome that was 20 or 30 million base pairs long before you could see it. And even then, you couldn't really identify it or know what the genes involved were. Using novel techniques like SNP arrays, or even more recently, next-generation sequencing, you can see small deletions that are only tens or hundreds of base pairs long. And with further and future use of next-generation sequencing, we'll be able to qualitatively and quantitatively identify all the deletions and insertions and mutations within the genome down to a one base pair resolution.
So do you think now these technologies that we have been using, so we'll go past Gims banding into things like spectral karyotyping, comparative genomic hybridization, FISH analysis, these were other ways that chromosomes could be painted and analyzed and looked at with a fair degree of accuracy. Do you think that these now are dead in the water or are going by the wayside and are being totally supplanted by these new technologies that you mentioned?
So these new technologies, such as in particular next-generation sequencing using something called paired N libraries, where you take a piece of DNA and then you sequence on either end of it and then map those sequences back to the genome, can discover things like complex translocations that were previously only attainable by using something like spectral karyotyping. So mm-hmm. If you had a translocation, you would see a piece of chromosome 6 stuck to chromosome 8, for example. Now if you sequence that piece of DNA and you realize that one end sequences to chromosome 6 and the other one to chromosome 8, you know that you have a translocation. That type of technology that will replace spectral karyotyping.
I see.
The one technology that I think will remain for now is FISH, or fluorescence in situ hybridization. And the reason for that is that all of these next-generation technologies and these high-resolution SNP technologies work on bulk tumor.
Mm-hmm.
So they only see aberrations that are present in all or most of the cells within a tumor. One of the major advantages of fluorescence in situ hybridization, or FISH, is that it allows you to see regions of the genome that are gained or lost in only a subset of cells. And we know that a large number of the oncogenes that are said to be amplified in medulloblastoma, like c-MYC, like n-MYC, and like NOTCH2, are only really present in a subset of cells.
Okay, so now we're using this next generation or deep sequencing, and it looks very exciting. Can you give some practical examples, maybe not so much for medulloblastoma, but perhaps other tumors, where this type of sequencing analysis has led to discoveries that previously could not be identified using these other techniques like FISH and CGH and spectral karyotyping?
To be very honest with you, Dr. Rucka, a lot of the very early experience with whole genome sequencing has been a bit disappointing. One of the very early examples that recently came out in Nature was whole genome sequencing of a sample of leukemia. They were looking at a type of leukemia that was known not to have a lot of regions of gain and loss in the genome. They sequenced that leukemia at 30 times coverage, so 3 gigabases in a normal human genome times 30 is 90 gigabases a sequence, plus I think about 20 times coverage for the same patient's normal tissues, so that's another 60 gigabases or 150 gigabases. So that's 150 billion base pairs that they sequenced. After all of that, they only found about, I think it was somewhere between 10 and 12 genes that were mutated. When they looked at those 10 or 12 genes and then resequenced them in another 200 tumors, none of those genes were mutated in the other leukemias. So that was actually very disappointing, and it sort of points to the idea that some people like Bert Vogelstein have been pushing that cancer is very heterogeneous at a molecular level.
Mm.
Some other positive findings that have come out more recently, though, are an example from Mark O'Meara's lab in Vancouver, where they sequenced a breast cancer and its metastasis, and they showed that the breast cancer and metastasis had each had a number of mutations in common, but also had a number of unique mutations, and it allowed them to derive some very novel insights into the process of metastasis for breast cancer.
Okay, so Michael, your area of expertise has been on the genomics of medulloblastoma, and primarily that's what your article is about in Neurosurgical Focus. What can you tell us about the issues around isochromosome 17q, which seems to be one of the most common non-random changes that occurs, and then that we've known about through Giemsa banding all the way up to the present time, and I'm sure which has fallen out of some of the other analyses that you've done, like through SNP arrays. What do you think is behind isochrome 17q that makes it so important in about 30% of medulloblastomas?
So isochromosome 17q is when you take a normal chromosome 17 and you snap off most of the P-arm in two copies, and then you ram them together so that you end up with a composite chromosome that consists of two Q-arms, two centromeres, and a little nub of P on either side that's stuck together. And as you say, if you look at medulloblastomas as a whole, it accounts for about 30% of medulloblastomas. Perhaps very important to note, though, is that you never see isochromosome 17q in either Wnt or sonic hedgehog group medulloblastomas. It is just not found in those subgroups. Once you look at the remaining tumors, it's found in about 50 to 60% of them, suggesting that it is very important. A large number of groups down the years have looked for the tumor suppressor gene that everyone thought was driving the loss of chromosome 17p, but no one has been able to find anything like that. Similarly, other groups have been looking for a particular oncogene that's gained on 17q, wondering if that was driving the clonal acquisition of isochromosome 17q, but again, no one gene has been pinned down. One of the things that my lab's been doing in collaboration with the Sanger group is flow sorting normal chromosome 17 out of medulloblastoma cell lines that contain isochrome 17q to sequence the other 17p allele by deep sequencing using next-generation sequencing to try and find what the genes that are mutated on 17p are. The problem using these next-generation techniques is, in fact, we're finding many, many mutations, and we're not sure which ones of them are the relevant ones. I suspect what it'll come down to is that really part, at least, of the factors driving clonal selection of cells carrying an isochromosome 17q are a relative loss of P and a relative gain of Q, sort of haploinsufficiency on P and a relative gain or a low-level amplification on Q.
Great. And you've also recently been able to take a lot of this information on medulloblastoma in terms of genomics in the analyses that you've done and put it into a very practical perspective, because not every research laboratory, not every department of pathology where there are neuropathologists can do this high-level type of molecular analysis that you can do in your laboratory. So is this a moment when you can talk a little bit about what some of your findings have been in terms of subcategorizing medulloblastoma?
So a number of groups over the past few years have attempted to use genomics and principally transcriptional profiling to divide medulloblastoma up into subgroups. It's been known for some time, for example, that tumors that carry mutations in the gene encoding beta-catenin that result in a constitutively active and stable beta-catenin protein all have monosomy 6. These tumors segregate separately from the rest of medulloblastomas by transcriptional profiling, and when you look at them clinically, they have a 90 to 100% survival. So it's quite clear that those tumors represent a separate group. So some initial efforts from Richard Gilbertson's lab, and then subsequently Marcel Kuhl's lab in Holland discussed the existence of perhaps five or six groups of medulloblastoma. From my lab, with the help of Stefan Pfister and Andrei Korshinov from the German Cancer Research Institute, shows that there probably is really four groups of medulloblastoma: the Wnt subgroup that's previously been described, the hedgehog group that all cluster together, and two other groups that consist predominantly of classic medulloblastomas, a lot of which have isochromosome 17q, as we discussed, which we're calling group C and group D. The way to diagnose these in the past, or to subgroup these medulloblastomas, has been through transcriptional profiling or perhaps through FISH markers, which, as you say, is not widely available across the globe. With the help of Drs. Pfister and Korshinov in Heidelberg, we've been able to develop a set of four antibodies that are commercially available for a set of four proteins that are encoded by four genes, each of which is only expressed in one of the subgroups of medulloblastoma. So by applying these four antibodies, using immunohistochemistry, a technique that should be widely available around the world, we're now able to assign every medulloblastoma to its unique subgroup. As the subgroups have differences in their demographics, their rate of metastases, their gender ratios, their transcriptional profile, their cancer genetic events, and indeed their outcomes, we think this should have a large impact on prognosticating for patients in the future and for stratifying future clinical trials.
Great. And the last question, Michael, we have these very advanced techniques now, like deep sequencing to study the DNA code, if you will. And for sure, those techniques will pick up mutations, which are pretty obvious, and deletions, some of which may be point mutations or deletions. But there's a whole other aspect of regulation on the DNA structure itself, and that is through this body of research which is coming forward on epigenetics. Will these techniques help you understand epigenetic regulation of genes that are important in causation of tumors like medulloblastoma, or do you have to rely on other techniques?
So people usually break epigenetics down into microRNAs, DNA methylation or CpG methylation, histone modification, and chromatin remodeling like SWI-SNF. So all the microRNA data should come out very nicely from these resequencing efforts, both the level of expression of the microRNAs and whether or not they're amplified or deleted within the genome. I don't think that the techniques that we just talked about, such as deep sequencing, will offer us a lot of insight into either post-translational modification of histones or nucleosome remodeling, but they will offer considerable insights in terms of CpG methylation or DNA methylation. Currently, a number of labs, including my own, are using various techniques to pull out all the portions of the genome that are DNA methylated and then analyzing them either by putting that DNA on a chip to see which areas are overrepresented, or more recently through deep sequencing of the CpG methylated enriched and the CpG methylated impoverished portions of the genome, thereby allowing us to identify regions of the genome that are methylated and presumably identifying novel tumor suppressor genes. What will probably happen as we go forward is people are developing techniques to analyze bisulfite-modified DNA across the genome. Bisulfite treatment on genomic DNA will change any unmethylated cytosines while leaving methylated cytosines alone. This results in a change in the sequence at the level of DNA sequencing and allows you to predict, or not predict, but tell exactly which cytosines have been methylated. The problem with that is that the bioinformatics is incredibly complex and really no one can handle it at a whole genome level now, but I suspect that will come in the next few years.
Any parting comments for us? Where would you like to see this field, all of it, in the next 10 years? What practical applications can you see filter down to institutions across the world for children who have medulloblastoma? What would be, in the best case scenario, how would you like to see this information?
I think we all know that most of the drug companies are not going to run out and spend millions or billions of dollars developing drugs for children with medulloblastoma because it's a small market and due to the medical legal risks of developing drugs in children. I think what we can hope is 5-10 years from now, when a child with a medulloblastoma has an operation, some of that tumor will go to the pathology lab where its complete genome sequence will be derived to identify all of the mutations, deletions, and amplifications. From that, there should be a list of targets, both genes and pathways, that are turned on or off inappropriately. And from there, we'll be able to pick from drugs that are targeted either against the mutations or against the pathways and derive tailored therapy for every child's tumor on an individual basis rather than just treating them as a mishmash or a lump of medulloblastomas as we do now. And because these drugs are being developed against these various genes, mutations, and pathways for treatment of common diseases like breast cancer, colon cancer, and lung cancer, we should be able to co-opt them for the use in our children with medulloblastoma.
Perfect, Michael. Well, thank you for your article recently published in Neurosurgical Focus, and I wish you continued success in all your research endeavors.
Thank you, Dr. Rock.
Thanks.
This concludes our podcast. Please join us in February 2010 for a discussion on surgery of gliomas in eloquent areas. For information on how to submit your research or to view upcoming topics, please visit thejns.org and click on Call for Papers under the Neurosurgical Focus icon. You can send comments to jnspodcast@thejns.org, and you can also follow us on Twitter.